I'm seriously disappointed that we don't have a microphone because it gets very taxing. What happened? What happened with the microphone? It's just
you want a little budget or something?
Something like that.
Y'all may want to move up a little bit.
It's not working. It's not.
Yeah. So if everybody, can move up, that would help. Because what you start doing is you start doing full head voice. It's called, and you don't think you're shouting, but after 30 minutes of it, it kills you. Okay. Great. Thanks. I'd like to point out to you that. That capitalist ideology has numerous popular myths that are propagated by the corporate media and by the political leaders, by everybody else, educators and such. Popular myths that justify its existence as a system, what some people call the Sacranda and the Miranda, you know. And the myth, for instance, there's the myth of capitalism and a societal prosperity, that capitalism creates prosperity. I would like to demonstrate to you that it doesn't create prosperity. And all your life you've been hearing that it does. And if you give me 10 seconds, this is Parenti's 10 second proof that it doesn't. It goes like this. Most of the world is capitalist and most of the world is poor. So it's just not true. Most of the world is getting more capitalist, more free market, more free trade, and most of the world is getting poorer. The number of people living in poverty is increasing at a faster rate than the world's population itself. So poverty is spreading. I rest my case. But what we hear is capitalism creates prosperity. We hear the myth of capitalism and individual success and access to wealth. That you too can get rich, the Horatio Alger thing, which is fed to us most studiously, most strenuously. The myth of capitalism and free market self-regulation, which I'll talk a little bit more about later. The myth of capitalism and international trade and peace, which Michael Minch, I think, dealt with. He touched on that yesterday. The myth of, and this is one I've written a lot about, the myth of capitalism and its supposed symbiotic relationship to democracy. And I write just the contrary, that when democracy starts to work too well, the capitalists go into high dudgeon and really oppose it and fight against it. There's one common myth or theme of capitalism. It's a minor one, but it always comes up when you discuss. I noticed lately, not as much, but over the years, always, if I would give a talk on capitalism and injustice and this, and that, it'd always be the Q&A, the first question would be, but what about the entrepreneurial spirit? What about the mom and pop? What about the mom and pop businesses? The two people who open up a business and then it works for a while, then they hire a couple of people and they create a couple of jobs and the commodity is liked and then they do a little more. And it's usually said in a very sentimental, nostalgic, sing-song voice also. And this is, you know, wonderful. And I have to say, you know what? I'm not talking about those people. I'm just not talking about them. And I've been accused on the internet somewhere of being soft on small business. And I am, actually, in a way. It's not the worst of economic endeavors, small businesses. But I'm talking about corporate capitalism. Titanic, giant corporate capitalism.
I just didn't have it on. Just using everybody.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
Technology, that's one of the contradictions in the movement, you know. Okay, thank you. That's better. A little easier on my throat. This guy's really limp, isn't he? There we go. Okay, I got it. Lenin made that verse. It's okay now. Somebody came in and thank you for taking care of that. Lenin made that point in his book, Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism. Just one line, he threw it out, it was a throwaway line. He said, 10 million small businesses mean nothing, a few giant cartels are everything. I mean, to say that back in, when was that, 1912 or so, when he was writing, that was quite something because, I mean, small business was much more proliferated then, and the giant cartels were smaller than they are today. But he saw what was happening, you know. He knew. And that's true today also. Not that small business can't be a political force. It can, especially at the local level and such. Then there's the core mythology of capitalism, and that's the invisible hand, you know. And it goes like this in a word, namely, that the most ruthless, selfish, opportunistic, greedy, calculating rapscallions, preferring or needing to apply the most heartless measures in the selfish, cold-blooded pursuit of corporate profits, will produce the best results of all, for the benefit of all. That's Adam Smith's Invisible Hand. That's the Parenti salting up the Adam Smith version. I put in a few more adjectives, but you know who said it good, and I couldn't find the quote now, but Keynes, Alfred Maynard Keynes said, what was the phrase he said? He said, the nastiest, rottenest, most rottenest, I mean, he used double superlatives, he was using bad grammar just to playfully exaggerate the point. He said, this theory says that the most rottenest people doing the most rottenest things will produce wonderful, glorious benefits for all of us. What a ridiculous theory. And he was going right to this invisible hand. There's a myth that prosperity is shared by us all. More for them means more for me. I have had people say that who I have interviewed about different things. A rising tide lifts all boats. We've all heard that phrase, haven't we? I always say, a rising tide sinks many ships and drowns lots of people. And we see that happening now. In fact, it is zero sum, still greater wealth for the very few and less for the rest of us. To the extent that the working class did better its position, and it did from, say, 1929 to 1950s or 60s, to the extent that happened, it was through the efforts and the struggle of the working class itself. I mean, how do you give credit to a ruling plutocracy for bringing us prosperity when they fought against every measure of prosperity? They fought tooth and nail and fang and claw against the increasing of minimum wages. They fought against unionization. They fought against social services and everything in the social wage, and they're still fighting against it. And how can you then say that, in fact, this is a... I hope that wasn't my phone, was it? No. Okay. You've caused us enough trouble already.
This is true.
Okay. So now, recession, I'd like to make a point about this recession. Recessions are not such bad things for the plutocracy, the corporate plutocracy. Recessions aren't things that they particularly are alarmed by. They have to pretend it. Their politicians have to say, oh, we're concerned about jobs and this and that. They're not doing anything. Where's the job bill that the Republican Party has? And the one that Obama is putting out, of course, is already duplicitous and a bit lame. In recessions, labor unions are tamed, smaller competitors are driven out or bought up for garage sale prices sometimes. You know, you have greater concentration. You can drive out small competitors more easily. You can do that during good times, too. People will work for almost any wage when they've been out of a job for, you know, almost a year and can't get anything, just to have some income. But meanwhile, in this jobless recovery, we have record profits and record bonuses and record payoffs to the corporate plutocracy. The crimes and the crises of corporate America, for which no one has gone to jail, as people have been pointing out, not a single person. There are now some criminal investigations into the mortgage, phony mortgage packages and such, but I'm still waiting for something to happen. How many years does it take to investigate the thing? These crimes and crises are not the result of wicked people as such, I would normally argue. They are not irrational departures from a rational system. Rather, the converse. They are the rational outcomes of a basically irrational and amoral system, the kind I just described with the invisible hand and the like. The multi-billion dollar government bailouts are themselves turned into an opportunity for pillage. Not only does the state fail to regulate, it becomes itself a source of plunder, pulling vast sums from the federal money machine and leaving the taxpayers to bleed. We are exploited not only as workers, but as taxpayers and as consumers. Those reactionaries who scold us for running to the government for handouts and for needing things instead of standing on our own feet are always themselves running to the government for bailouts and handouts. Why else do they have hundreds of lobbyists in Washington? I mean, they have... what are they doing? They're running to the government constantly. Corporate America yearly enjoys billions of dollars in subsidies, grants and aid, loan guarantees, bailouts, tax breaks, whatever else. And with all the profits it pulls in every year, corporate America, believe it or not, when you look at this, corporate America is on welfare like nobody else. I mean, they get more welfare than anybody. Now, the essence of free market corporate capitalism is the transformation of living nature into commodities and commodities into dead capital. When Warren Buffett is said to be worth $56 billion, it means that somewhere in there, it's a paper wealth. I mean, it's in bonds, it's in ownership, it's in this and that. It's got some productive capital too, of course, but it's mostly investment things. It means there's a promise that he's going to be able to cash all that stuff and turn it into money for cheeseburgers or whatever else, or a big, still bigger car, or more cars, more houses, and whatever. but there's a kind of regressive, impact of wealth that's so accumulated like that. It's not reinvested. It just turns into productive capital turns into finance capital. And when left entirely on its own devices, corporate capitalism foists its diseconomies and toxicity upon the general public and upon the natural environment. And it eventually begins to devour itself. If the paladins of corporate America want to know what really threatens our way of life, you know that phrase, our way of life, it's their way of life, their boundless pilfering of their own system, destroying the very foundation on which they stand. The more successful they are, the more deadly they become, like any parasite. I mean, we are suffering from their victories, which the more thoroughly they plunder their own economy and our environment, the closer they bring themselves and us to catastrophe. We know the basic function of the capitalist state is to defend those who control the means of production and wealth and all that from those who must work for those who control. So the capitalist state is in defense of capitalism. There's no doubt about that. But there's another function of the state which nobody ever talks about really often. I've started to anyway, and that's the capitalist state. This consists of preventing the capitalist system from devouring itself. That is, to protect capitalism from the capitalists. Marx said it once. He said, one capitalist will destroy many capitalists. I mean, it's a system that's at war, not only with the environment, not only with the working class, but with itself. It's self-devouring and self-destructive. An economy that's dedicated to speed ups, wage cuts, making workers produce more and more for less and less, is always in danger of a crash. It's an economy that's constantly seeking ways of maximizing profits. To maximize profits, you've got to keep wages down. But someone has to buy all these goods and services being produced, and for that, you have to keep wages up. So there's a chronic tendency, and we're seeing it today, toward overproduction of private sector goods and services, while at the same time you have underconsumption of necessities by the working populace. Overproduction for one... overproduction of a whole consumer society, and meanwhile you don't have, people don't have enough to eat, or enough shelter, decent shelter, and the like. And the thing about recessions and crises, if you look at the history of American capitalism, for instance, it's rather striking that recessions and crises, when you hear, oh, we're in a special time now, we're in a crisis, we're in a recession, that's the normal time. That's the normal condition of capitalism throughout its history. That's the normal condition of the free market. It's always in a state of chaos. Doesn't Marx have a phrase for that? I'm trying to remember. The chaos of production? No.
Anarchy of production.
The anarchy of production, thank you. Anarchy of production, and we're talking about anarchy, not anarchism, which some anarchists, some young anarchists themselves have, don't make a correct distinction between that. It's not anarchy you're pursuing, and it's anarchism if you are an anarchist. But the anarchy of production is a constant condition. It's always there. Look at American history. The recession of 1790. I mean, the country was only like 10 years old. The Constitution has just been ratified in May 1787. Here it was 1790, and the economy was in recession. The panic of 1797. The recession of 1802 to 1804. More than 20 more recessions came along in the 19th century. Most notably, the Long Depression of 1873 went on for 5.5 years, at least 5.5 years. Four recessions in the 1890s alone. And this was when manufacturing was surging. Do you know in the 1890s, this is a remarkable datum, in the 1890s, the United States was already the largest manufacturing power in the world. Larger than Germany, larger than England, larger than any other place. And yet they were having recession 1890, 1893, 1896, 1899 to 1900. And skip a few, you can go on. Three substantial recessions in the 1920s, panics, crashes, the great crash of 1929 that went on right from 1929 on to 1941, 42, and then a war came along and took us out of that recession. And after the war, 49, 53, 58, and you can go on. Crises, panic, recession, crash, those are the normal conditions of free market capitalism. The normal life of the profit pathologist is crises followed by crises. And at the individual level, there's also crises. You know, you could almost say the ontogenetic recapitulates the phylogenetic, is called that. The individual goes through all the stages that the whole phylum does, the whole collectivity. No, I don't think so. That doesn't really apply here. But what it just means is that people, you know, you're talking, when all those numbers I was giving you, recession this year and that year, you're talking about really hardship. You're talking about people who are really suffering severe deprivation and loss and whatever else. So under capitalism, we live in our personal recessions, our personal crises and personal panics. And we should maybe do a little more study how objective economic conditions influence subjective psychology. You get very little of that, really, in social psychology and in psychology and such. The way in which, or family conflicts, how families would do much better with each other if things were affluent, if life was more comfortable, if there wasn't so much fear of want and the like. I saw that in my own family, which was an Italian immigrant family that came here in 1870, and one grandpa and the other one came here in 1908 or so. Very hard for the immigrant generation. Very hard. These kids had to work hard and very stressed and very embattled too. And the years later, when the years were more prosperous and they got their own homes and this and that, by the 1960s and such, and people seemed much different. They seemed more relaxed and all that. And I wonder if it wasn't because life was easier and people could be nicer. But in any case, we rarely go into how poverty is a human thing and what it all means and how it plays out at the individual level. Now, under the profit plutocracy, the environment is treated as a disposable resource. We all know that corporate America, the environment is just something they see first as limitless. It's just going to go on. We're not going to run out of fresh air. We can keep poisoning the air. The water is limitless. The forests are going to be limitless. The resources are going to be, it's just out there. And if it isn't, who cares? I got my next year's bottom line to worry about. I'm not going to be worrying about what's going to happen 20, 30 years from now, whatever. Of living nature, the capitalist has no measure. Living nature, no. When nature is turned into a commodity or a resource for commodities, then he starts measuring and calculating. Wealth becomes addictive. Fortune whets the appetite for still more fortune. There's no end to the amount of money one might wish to accumulate. Now, I personally have written, oh, thanks. You saved the day again, thank you. I've personally written against psychopolitics. I have an article called Against Psychohistory or Against Psychopolitics. It's in my book, History as Mystery. Probably one of the more seriously unread articles I've ever written. But I found again and again people psychologizing about political leaders and saying, or for instance, a lot of the studies done on American presidents, that this president was this way and he wasn't sure and he had to prove something, and that president was that way and he had some narcissistic something, and this president had a thing about his father and all. And they get into really spinning all kinds of embroidery and whatever you want to. And I would point out and say, you know, you take every one of those presidents, Polk, McKinley, name them, Wilson, Coolidge, Teddy Roosevelt, Reagan, on and on, today Clinton, Bush 1, Bush 2, Obama, they all have different biographies. They all have different kinds of fathers. They all have different kinds of mothers. They all come from different stratum. One is a Midwestern Republican, another one comes from New England, another one comes from wherever. And they all do the same thing when they're in power. They all serve the empire. They all go in and invade and expropriate, and they all serve that ruling class. So all that psychologizing to try to explain policy, to try to explain the forces of society by psychologizing, I have written and against. I've urged people to please do an analysis of the political economy, before you start psychologizing. Having said all that, I want to now contradict myself and say I have become a psychologizer, at least in this essay anyway. I'm talking about profit pathology. I expropriated a psychological term. I've decided that these guys really are crazy, that there's something really addictive about this wealth, that when a guy has, when someone has $12 billion, and he has more money than he could spend in 1,000 lifetimes, even if he took all day, every day to spend his money, he would not be able to spend them, when he is worried most of all about changing that 12 billion to 15 billion, and that's his passion and that's his drive, and then after he gets to 15 billion, he wants to get it to 20 billion, and that's what he's doing, and he will pursue wars, and he will pursue murder, and he will pursue deceptions, and whatever else to do these things, then I say, these guys are addicts. Wealth is very addictive. When it starts to accumulate, you want more of it, and you want to keep it, and you want to get more. And there's something in you that says, if I can get more and more, I may never die. You know, I mean, I'm just getting stronger and greater, whatever else. Fortunately, they do die, and that's kind of a nice, gives me a nice warm fuzzy feeling whenever one of them drop dead. I always look at the obits and the times and such. So, it's an obsessional pathology, a monomania that blots out every other human consideration. Look at what they've done to Iraq. They've destroyed that country. They've destroyed its lands, its museums, its schools, its transportation, its lives. A million people have had their lives ruined or taken away. And all of that is to make that little region a little safer for the empire that serves the plutocracy. They're more wedded to their wealth, in fact, than they are to the earth upon which they live. I mean, if you ask this guy and say, please save this, please save the earth, we're going under, and cast away those bags of gold you got, he'll say, yeah, are you crazy? He'll go down hugging his gold. He'll go off the edge of the cliff hugging his gold. Thomas Jefferson had a line on that. He said, the merchant's loyalty to any community is the land in which he's standing while he's waiting for his ships to come in. That's the country that he's loyal to at the time. It's a phrase, something like that. There was a New Yorker cartoon. In fact, I reproduced it in the 9th edition of Democracy for the Few. The cartoon shows a corporate executive standing at a lectern, just like I'm doing now, and, you know, members of the board are sitting there listening to him, and he's saying as follows. And so, while the end of the world scenario will be rife with unimaginable horrors, we believe that the pre-end of the world period will be filled with unprecedented opportunities for profit. You followed all that? That the bus is going off the cliff and these guys are running up the aisle trying to sell us safety belts, you know, and at exorbitant prices. It's not such a joke, this thing. Because you see this being acted out. Years ago, I once said, the only thing that's going to hit it home to these prophet pathologists that global warming is happening is when the Arctic begins to melt. I didn't say Arctic. I said when the North Pole begins to melt. Never believing that the North Pole was going to start melting in my lifetime. And sure enough, we have this immense Arctic meltdown. And was I wrong? I said, that's going to be such a horrendous thing. What it's going to do to the temperate currents, too, is another question. I mean, it may turn England into Siberia and the like. There are all sorts of horrible things that may be coming up. These guys aren't, this isn't waking them up. I said something horrendous like that. That's the only thing that can shake them. No, you're talking about addicts, and the addict knows only one thing, and that's his fix. He'll sell his mother, he'll sell his kids, he'll sell anything for that fix. He just needs that. And that's where these guys are. We're today facing an Arctic meltdown that carries the most horrendous implications for the ocean Gulf streams and everything else there, coastal water levels, the planet's entire temperate zone. So how do they respond? They respond like monomaniacal profiteers. They are celebrating the opening of the Arctic. It's the awakening of what? That thing that for more than 200 years, more before Lewis and Clark, the Northwest Passage. We have now a Northwest Passage. No more of this having to go all the way around down to Panama or around Cape Horn there. At last, finally, we can we can cut 10,000 miles off our trade trips and such, just go right over the top. The Earth, you know, gets very small up there. It's very wide around the equator and very relatively small. And they're talking about this as what great opportunities we'll have for trading. And the other thing that they're talking about is what? The oil reserves under the Arctic, that now they can drill. They can create more fossil fuel that will create more of this warming and the very crises that made these things accessible. So, more meltdown means more oil and more profits. And such is the mantra of the free marketeers who think that the world belongs to them. So what, and I'm going to try to get through this quick. Am I going too long? I'm getting to the alternatives, because I know that the talk was called Profit Pathology and Alternatives to It. What are the alternatives to profit pathology and corporate capitalism? Well, I'll tell you one. It's called socialism. Socialism, but isn't socialism a dream in theory and a nightmare in practice? No. I advocate socialism because it works. Not those people say, oh, it's never really been tried. I mean, real socialism has never really been tried. That's like the Christians who say, oh, well, real Christians, you know, real Christianity has never really been tried, but it's a beautiful religion. But the only two Christians we've ever seen, the only two true Christians was Jesus Christ and Spinoza, and they were both Jews, you know. So we just got to wait for the real thing, you know, that it's out there somewhere. The anarchists are always lying about that. Oh, anarchism has never been tried in all its purity and perfection. No, it has been tried, and it works. We have it all the time. I had students that, when I was teaching at State University of New York, this was now 30 years ago when public education was public education. They've been privatizing public education piecemeal by just raising the tuitions and such, which is a form of privatization. But the students would say, socialism, how would it even work? I said, well, you're sitting in it right now. I mean, you're in a public school, State University. It's publicly funded. You go through a whole year paying $300. That doesn't even begin to touch the cost of it. So looking at the actual practices and realities that are before your very eyes, rather than this idea of the clash of two great ideologies, socialism versus capitalism, communism versus democracy, which is incorrect juxtaposition. Rather than thinking of that, look at these actual practices. You're sitting in an institution that's not for profit, publicly funded. It has qualified teachers and students. In fact, that SUNY campus had a better faculty and students than most of the private schools that were around there. Well, what about, look at socialism in the Soviet Union and China. What a failure. Well, I don't know if it was a failure. What China and Russia did was take two massive countries with hundreds of millions of people in it who knew nothing but destitution, deprivation, immiseration, and turned them into nations that where people had enough to eat, the development of social life, communal life, education, advance for everybody. I mean, the difference between China and India today, where China has a poverty level maybe of 20-30%, and India has a poverty level of maybe 80-85%, and a real poverty level. I mean, we're talking about villages where the women lend each other their monthly rags, their menstrual rags. They wash them out, I presume. But this is they're so poor that they've got to rotate. Things like that. I mean, utter deprivation. We have where children are still starving and the like, compared to China. And the difference is that China had 40 years of socialism, 40 years of education, 40 years of building the infrastructure, 40 years of development. And now that's being, of course, used for both in China and Russia, more privatization, and there comes with more privatization and such, there comes more consumer prosperity for a certain stratum, more wealth for a selected few, and more poverty for millions. So poverty is coming back, but China is building on its socialism. It's building its capitalist economy on its socialist background achievements. And the trouble with India still has that same feudal class that the Chinese got rid of. I mean, they either killed some of those guys or put them into rehabilitation camps or put them to work in other places. In India, those feudal landlords still control more than half the population. As I say, I think it's as high as 80%. Socialism. Do we really want less socialism? We have other examples of it. Medical care. In France and Norway and Finland, you have socialized medicine. It's better care. They spend less, yet they seem to have more. It costs the patients very little. Lower cost to society. There's no profiteering. That's why no one goes without. You have happier doctors and other medical personnel. Doctors here, talk to doctors here. What's happening to them. I know so many doctors who are bitter. They can't get payments from the medical insurance companies. They have to hire extra people on staff. They're practically going broke or they're in debt because they're not getting, because insurance isn't insuring anything, private insurance. The function of private insurance is to withhold treatment and increase your premiums and maximize profits. That's the point. Do you really want a capitalist system? Do you really want somebody, a service that depends on delivery by someone whose intent is to maximize profits for himself or herself? We have medical care where we spend proportionally more money than all these, more money than Finland or France or Denmark or Norway, whatever. With more money, we have rich hospitals, rich insurance companies, rich HMOs. Millions go without coverage, though. Millions go broke to pay their medical bills. Millions delay treatment. They go without treatment because they can't afford it. Transportation is another thing. Do you really want transportation that's privately owned, that's run by people whose intent is not safe transportation, but to maximize profits? We have PG&E in Northern California. It's the biggest, richest utility. We people in Northern California pay higher rates than anyone else in the whole country. It's a privately owned gas and electric company, and they just killed 8 people in San Bruno when the gas pipes blew up. This is after reports from the people in the community that they smelled gas. This is after the state had given them money to improve and increase the safety. And what did they do with that money? They put it to run a referendum to prevent any public ownership of utilities. They lost, but they're still privately owned. So this is, look at the examples. Look at what capitalism does. In transportation, it's interesting because you have Amtrak. And Amtrak gets built up by the government, it gets these subsidies, it's able to run, the trains get better and all that. Then they float stock again, and it gets privatized. You get private owners, they come in, and then they begin to milk this system, because to you it's a train, and its function is to get you somewhere. To them, it's a source of profit and income. And then they milk it, and then Amtrak starts going down, and then the government has to come in and bail them out again, and take it, pick it up again. And this has happened several times already. So what you have is socialism subsidizing capitalism. And this is one of the things we have to keep pointing out and talking about how it has to break. Capitalism works because it always has socialism to bail it out. The trucking industry gets the feds to build the highways. Fire department. Do you want a volunteer fire department? We do have some around America in the country. They're not as good. They're not as available. They're not as well trained or well equipped or well financed. Public schools, socialist, are better than charter schools. A number of communities are getting rid of their charter schools and going back to public schools. Now, not all things need to be socialized. In Cuba, for instance, they're doing small service businesses. This is where I've been accused, being soft on small businesses. I do think you could have a society where some kinds of services can be private, where worker control, that's even better. You know, in Cuba, when you had to wait 3 days for a state plumber to come, and then he just knocks the thing down and clears it out and blocks then the apartment below and goes home. And there are cases like that. And you can read a remarkable document by, God, I'm blocking it. What's Fidel's brother's name?
Raul
Castro. A document he wrote about 20 years ago. I quoted it in my book, Black Shirts and Reds. He talks about the goof-offs, the lack of work discipline, the people lifting stuff out from the common stock and taking it home and using it for personal profit and such, covering up for fellow workers who are absent and the like. So he talked about this a long time ago. It's interesting that it's Raul Castro who's actually starting a small service business. You could have worker cooperatives. There's one in Berkeley where I live, Berkeley, California. It's a worker cooperative. They make bread and they sell cheeses. It's marvelous. They make cheeses and bread and pizzas that are, I don't even like pizza, but these are terrific. So in other words, you can have worker cooperatives that actually have good quality, specialty stuff. And the workers come in and they share in the earnings. Now note my word, earnings, not profits. They don't share in the profits. Profits are something you make when you're not working, you see. I have to make that clear. People have come up to me and say, well, you make a profit on your books. I said, no, wait a minute, I don't make a profit. I wrote the goddamn book, you know. I busted my back for a year to write that book, a year and a half to write that book. So I'm not just sitting there I get 7% on each book. My publisher makes more on each book than I do. But I wrote that book, and the editors who edited the book, and the people who do the sales and the advertising, they're all putting value into the commodity, you see. And then the guy at the end of the line, he takes it in. So these worker cooperatives are not for profit, but workers, depending on how long you've been with the cooperative, that's your portion of share and such, and they make something on this. And they're very good, and they're very reasonable. There are housing cooperatives. There are all sorts of worker cooperatives. Gar Alperovitz has written a book on that. I think he went around the country a bit and has seen a lot of that. There are consumer cooperatives and all. So let me just end right there and say, what is to be done? Ideological struggle, a critical examination of capitalism. There are people who call themselves on the left who are utterly afraid of ideology. Someone was just telling me, I think it was you, Brett, about a anti-war rally they were going to have, and they used the word imperialism in it, and that frightened people away. What do you think is happening? It is imperialism coming out of Gazoo. I just wrote a book called The Face of Imperialism. But they are so afraid of anything that's a shade to the left of them. They're receptive to anything that's to the right and center, whatever else. But to the left of them, they are so... And that shows that the ideological impetus here has been taken by the conservatives. They understand that ideas count and words are weapons for ideas. And they are out there all the time, and we have to do the same. Not just struggling on this issue or that, but building up an ideological narrative, an analysis that shows and connects the dots. And then also, in addition to that, there's struggle in the workplace and in government and everywhere else. I think right now my feelings about the electoral struggle, I think electoral struggle is also worthwhile, that sometimes there are times when it's worth running a candidate for office. It depends when it can be an awful waste of time and absorption of resources and effort, leading nowhere. You get no press coverage. I've run for office on the third party ticket called Liberty Union Party back in early 1970. I ran for Congress, and Vermont had one congressman, so I got the whole state. I went all over, and I got on a lot of radio shows, and I ran for the House of Representatives. And running on our ticket for Senate was a guy named Bernie Sanders, an old friend of mine, who today actually became mayor of Burlington, then he became congressman, and now he's senator from Vermont. And it's good to have a voice like that, and although he's not perfect, you know, he supported the bombing and the killing and destruction of Yugoslavia, and I've never forgiven him for that. But also the struggle for alternative institutions like these worker co-ops and the like. So in other words, we have to struggle both in theory and in practice. And I'm going to end your struggle of having to listen to me now by stopping and thanking you for your kind attention.